Do we have sound today?
Yes.
Everything all right? Good. Well, it's encouraging to see you back, even though you had so much trouble hearing and I had so much trouble speaking yesterday. I thought a little bit about yesterday, and knowing the audience a little better now, most of you are people who have some sort of contact with the history of South Africa and its press. I thought I'd adjust a little bit and maybe get into some of the controversies a little bit more than I was thinking of doing. I wanted to make one or two opening points. Firstly, I'm going to get into what are really a lot of ethical issues between journalists and politicians. I'm very alive to them and I'm happy to talk about them later, but for the moment I'd like to be as frank as I can about what people were saying, what they were writing and what they were doing behind the scenes. And then it's obviously the ethical issues need to be raised in some way. Secondly, one of the things that strikes me about the history as I've been reading it is the importance of the World Wars in South Africa, particularly World War II in this case. World War I is being commemorated around the world now because of 100 years, and World War II to some extent, but of course because of the way our history was taught to us in South Africa, we never really got what seems to me a rather important notion of the role that World War II had in shaping South Africa. Just to give you an idea, to cast our minds just before World War II and give you two stories of press censorship in South Africa that give you a kind of flavour that obviously things very, very much changed after World War II. The first comes from some recently declassified Whitehall documents of a meeting that took place in December the 6th, 1936 in London, when the Cape Times journalist in London sent a cable saying that the king was about to abdicate. MI6 confiscated the cable, didn't get through, and the Home Secretary, Sir John Simon, summoned the British journalist working for the Cape Times, Neil Forbes Grant, to a meeting, and this is how the conversation went. I reminded him that in 1815, a false rumor that we had lost the Battle of Waterloo produced a financial crisis and ruined many people. I asked him if he did not realize that his responsibilities as a journalist and an Englishman made the sending of such a message without definite authority as to its truth very improper and reckless. Grant said he had a very highly placed source, but under this withering call to patriotism, Grant, according to the Home Secretary, replied, and this is in the document, that this has been a lesson to me and that I will always have this experience in mind when discharging my responsibilities in the future. Of course, 4 days later, King Edward abdicated. So it was not the first or last time that a politician denied the truth to kill an accurate story. The second example I want to give is just a couple of years later, 1939, General Herzog in power as Prime Minister here before the declaration of war. And he called in all the editors of the South African press on the request, very strong request, of the German minister from the German embassy to persuade Herzog to establish press censorship to prevent unfriendly comments about Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy. Unlike his extremist son Albert, General Herzog, who we discussed yesterday, brought out Lord Reith to establish British BBC-style journalism, felt torn in different directions. And in the course of this discussion, according to one of the editors who was there, Green, Herzog's chief point was that the anti-Nazi tone of leading South African newspapers, of which the German minister complained bitterly, was bad for trade. But during the conversation, a leading editor asked the Prime Minister point blank, did he expect the newspapers to condone cold-blooded crimes of the Nazis, such as a particular recent example? And Herzog said, of course not. And the editor said, but don't you realize, sir, that nothing short of approval of such deeds would satisfy the German minister? So the South African Prime Minister didn't press the point, and in fact the solution that was reached was they set up a press council, a self-regulatory press council, which was fairly toothless, and that sort of satisfied both sides for the time being. Of course, these things, we'll talk tomorrow about these issues being very, very live issues here in South Africa now, and also about the issues in the independent group, which some of you are very aware of, the firing of the editor of the Cape Times and where that fits in to the kind of press battles we might be facing quite soon. Now, Mandela's secret friend, who I'm going to talk about first, was a man who exposed the Brudebond, and I think historically, it ranks up there with pretty much any journalistic investigation you could think of, because it's not something that was done in a way in which government officials were actually trying to get it leak out as part of some internal battle, and that of course is what happens. Even the courageous work of our Muldergate and America's Watergate, there were people on the inside who had their own reasons for getting it out. But in the light of what I thought was the importance of the Brudebond revelations, there is some revisionist history going on at the moment in South Africa, which is arguing very differently, that the Brudebond had no real power. And this comes primarily from a very good man, a very good historian, Professor Herman Hillier in Stellenbosch. But he is now arguing that the Brudebond had no influence, with perhaps the exception of education, and even there he sort of hedges it about. He also argues that Verwoerd is much misunderstood, and his latest book on the last Afrikaner leaders seems to give the impression, and in discussions I've attended of his, that really it leaves me with the feeling that he's looking for Afrikaner heroes. And I would say in all the wrong places. There are many Afrikaner heroes, and some of them I'm going to refer to here, but I don't think they were the ones that he said. But after Hillier, being a non-professional historian and somewhat uncertain about my own credentials, I have spent some time in Stellenbosch talking to other academics, and I'm quite satisfied now that Gelimer's view of the Broederbond will not stand the test of time. I just don't, I think there is so much evidence, and I've got quite a lot of it in my book, that the Broederbond was extremely powerful. Just on the subject we're dealing with, this man, Mayer, who was head of the Broederbond and the SABC, when he decided to start television in South Africa, as you know, as we discussed yesterday, that was 47 years after it was predicted. There was first a Broederbond meeting and discussion and seminar and decision to start television, and then the government set up a commission of inquiry on whether they should have television, and Mayer assured the Broederbond meetings that now that we've agreed it will happen. So, you know, that's just one of many, many examples where the Broederbond's influence was considerable. But it wasn't necessarily formalized that they took every decision and the government just implemented it. But certainly their importance should not be underestimated. Now, having said that, that gives me license to go on to tell the story I now want to tell. This is not Mandela's secret friend. This is Joel Mervis, who was the editor of the Sunday Times when the Broederbond expose started. And the more broad point I want to make, that he came in 57 or 59, and Lawrence Gander became editor of the Rand Daily Mail, and Mervis became editor of the Sunday Times. What was really important to me about the two of them, Gander had served in the war, Mervis hadn't, but they were the first two South African-born editors of those major papers, especially Gander, who really weren't jingoists, who weren't involved with Britain's interests and Britain's needs and were focused on South Africa. There were one or two others in the past, but significantly, I think Mervis and Gander are the ones that really count in this context, in the big papers. And Mervis was an interesting character. His father had fought in the Boer, was Jewish from the Free State. His father had fought on the Boer Wars, on the Boer side in the Boer War. His uncle was mayor of Clockerlan, a small Free State town in pre-Anglo-Boer War Free State Republic times. So he was a Free State Republican. And what this meant was, although he was not especially liberal on race issues, but he understood the Afrikaner, and he determined to really unveil what was really going on, and he knew about it from his own historic roots. And so he started the coverage of the Broederbond extensively from the day he took over as editor of the Sunday Times. Now this is Charles Blumberg, who was the reporter who did most of the work. And Charles is the person I've been referring to, and we'll talk about him a little bit more. He was secretly a friend of Mandela's, and both are dead now, unfortunately. But I've spoken to both Charles and Mandela about their relationship, and it's interesting to me because Charles's entire life was devoted to understanding Afrikanerdom and understanding apartheid theory what, if any, its roots were in Europe. And so while Charles was writing about the Broederbond in the Sunday Times, he was a political reporter of the biggest paper in the country, very influential, he would periodically walk up the street from Main Street, where some of us here used to work, and once up Moy Street in Johannesburg, and turn right into Doornfontein, where he'd get into the back of a car driven by a scruffy-looking black man going under the name of David, who was really a Mandela, and Mandela would drive around in the front seat and Charles would sit in the back seat, looking as though Charles was the boss and Mandela was the... But Charles was a member of the Congress of Democrats. I think a rather passive member. I've checked with various people in the COD, the Congress of Democrats, who are alive today, was the white wing of the Congress Alliance, and some people argue it was completely communist or semi-communist, whatever. But Charles was an inactive member, but he was a member, and he regarded Mandela as, I guess, his leader. And so he was seeing Mandela while Mandela was on the run, And he never ever wrote about that in the newspapers for two reasons that he gave me. The reason he gave me was that he didn't think Mervis was that interested in black politics in the way he was. But obviously there was another reason, which was confidentiality. He'd have been worried that it could have hurt Mandela and could have hurt Charles. But Charles it was a really remarkable figure, and I think his... And I want to now go into tell you a little bit about how he did it, what he did and how he did it. When he got involved, the last journalist to try and get close to the Broodbourne fire was George Hurd, the father of Tony Hurd, who many of you know, who was editor of the Cape Times for many years. And George Hurd disappeared on his way to his mother-in-law's house for dinner one night in his Navy uniform in 1945. Tony has done quite a lot of research to try and track down what happened to him. He believes that his body was thrown down a mine shaft somewhere in the Transvaal in about shortly after he was captured. None of this has been proved, but he gets this from his understanding of post-1994 examination of intelligence. Now, Charles was very aware of this, and he was determined to do what he could to expose the Broederbund and to survive. And now, the other interesting thing about Mervis and Blumberg's relationship, Mervis confessed himself baffled by Blumberg's success. This is Mervis's description from Blumberg. Blumberg was a shrinking violet, always ill at ease and deferential to the extent of giving the impression he was backing out of the room in the middle of a sentence. Hardly the equipment, one would say, for a reporter mixed up in the rough and tumble of politics, yet it paid off. For reasons unknown, politicians were eager to take him into their confidence, and he made a notable contribution to the paper's catalogue of political disclosures. In 1963, he broke the Broederbund wide open, the first man to do so. Now, in fact, it was no accident, and as I will show, Charles devoted the rest of his life to a very, very fascinating, rich experiences in every sense except financial. He lived in poverty, but had an otherwise very rich life. He befriended Sir Alec Douglas Hume when he was Prime Minister in Downing Street. He used to have dinner 10 Downing Street. I spoke this week to Sir Jeremy Isaacs, who was one of the most important television figures in Britain, and he remembers him very fondly. The historian, the left-wing historian Eric Hobsbawm, also very famous. I've been in touch with his daughter recently. The family remember him very fondly. So he made extraordinary connections in Britain. And when Charles used to tell me these stories, like any journalist, you sort of put them in the back of your mind and sort of wait for proof. Well, as I say, I've got the proof from both Isaac's and Hobsbawm's family, and the number 10 Downing Street one seemed the most curious of all, because, of course, Alec Douglas Hume was a Tory Prime Minister, and Charles always wore three or four jerseys. He was very sick, he was poor, he carried plastic bags around full of his material. And how did he get into Downing Street? But I've actually confirmed that he did go there for dinner. He was friendly with the family, so Alec liked him, and they had a holiday in Switzerland with the family together during that time. So Charles was a remarkable guy, what he did was, the way he exposed it was, he was covering it extensively. He believed that a journalist could get any story he wanted to if he tried hard enough, and he was out to get the Broederbund, and he got it. And he did it by obvious kind of footwork, but he befriended Albert Kaiser, who was a very respected theologian, Afrikaner theologian, who landed up, who'd believed in apartheid until he was asked to go on a church commission to examine whether apartheid could be theologically defended. And he went into it believing it could, and he came out believing it could not. And he was, as many of you will remember, he was tried for heresy, his car was tampered with, his wife's car was tampered with. She was in an accident and she never recovered fully, and she lived in institutions till she died. He was defrocked, he was removed from his university. So their lives were pretty much ruined. There was an attempt on his car as well, but because he'd been tipped off, he checked and found it in time. But he was the source for the original breakthroughs. Now, the breakthroughs were that Kaiser was not a member of the Brüderbund. His father was, but he wasn't. He had chosen not to be. But he knew Beyers Nodir, and Beyers Nodir was at that time a member of the Brüderbund, and he brought him some documents. And Kaiser, without telling Nodir he was doing it, showed them to Charles, and Charles published them. Among the content of the documents was how the church was being used, that people who turned against Kaiser in the church, people who'd supported Kaiser in his heresy trial, were defrocked or pushed out of their positions in the church under Brüderbund pressure and various things like that. He got evidence of. And he also got a document in which it said that the new secretary of the Brüderbund is Dr. Piet Kurnoff. This is his name, and this is the front we're going to use for him. This is the title he'll have in public, so he can work behind the scenes but semi in public. And Charles published all of that, including his secret telephone number, which of course became unusable. Shortly after that, Charles felt forced to leave the country. He got a tip-off that something was coming from. He was fearful. He was very, very conscious of what had happened to George Hurd, which was, that stage, 15, 16, 17 years before. And he left. And, of course, it was the time where Mandela, I think it had been arrested by this point. And, you know, it was that time that you've all read about so much. And so he went to Britain. He worked on a PhD, and he spent quite a bit of time at the Vrije Universiteit of Amsterdam, which is really where South Africa's Dutch Reformed Church theology primarily was practiced. What he found was that the PhDs of Piet Mayer and not Verwoerd, but Diedrichs and several others of the theorists of apartheid were all based on one particular theologian, Abraham Kuyper, K-U-Y-P-E-R. And Kuyper was quite a fascinating character. He was both a leading theologian, leading thinker, editor of a newspaper, but also Prime Minister of the Netherlands just around the turn of the century for a few years. And he'd founded the Vrije Universiteit of Amsterdam, and the Vrije University of Amsterdam was the model for Potchefstroom University. So Charles spent quite a bit of time in Holland trying to understand what the real connection was, and the conclusion he reached was that really Kuyper led to two different threads. In other words, Kuyper was not pro-apartheid or pro-Nazi, although his son joined the Nazi party, there was a thread of Kuyperism that became more or less social democrat. So there were different people used it to turn it in different directions, and it was based on, I'm not a theologian, but it was based on the notion that that Kuyper had advanced the argument that people must have souveraniteit en eie kring, sovereignty in your own circle, and that your first responsibility was to your family, and then to your church and your community and so on, and only latterly to other people. And this had been distorted in South Africa to be an argument for apartheid. He wrote about 750,000 words, which have never been published. And I've been trying to track down the manuscript. Now, after he died, a slim volume was published posthumously by Macmillan, which I have, and it's interesting, but it's rather slim. And I've been trying to, and it was edited by Saul Dubow, whom some of you will know, the South African historian living in Britain. There is still a mass of this documentation, and I've taken the published book to Stellenbosch to show to some theologians and see if they consider it stands up, and they do say it stands up well. So clearly he did something important. Now, the next thing that's rather interesting is that in 1976, of course, we got television. Piet Mayer was still the head of SABC, and they'd always feared it for one obvious reason, which proved to be a well-justified fear, which was that television has a voracious appetite. Once you start it, it just keeps sucking in material and you use it, and then the next day there's another 24 hours to fill, or 12 hours, or however many hours you have. And they also felt they needed some kind of marquee television to show how it could be educational, and they chose, of all things, The World at War, which had been done by Sir Jeremy Isaacs, who was then head of Thames Television, with Laurence Olivier as the narrator. What Mayer probably didn't realize was that Charles was responsible for two of its primary episodes, the ones that won the awards, the one on the Holocaust itself and the one on the occupation of the Nazi occupation of Holland. And he'd been researching it because he felt, and this is partly why I think the war is so underappreciated, the role of the war is so underappreciated. Going into World War II, the Dutch church and Dutch society had a great deal of fellow feeling towards Afrikanerdom. And the fact that most Afrikaner nationalists who were not Nazis did want a German victory because of hatred of Britain and the feeling that this would finally end the British yoke and that they could get freedom at last. But when the Nazis invaded Holland, South African nationalists did not take a stand. They were still on the side of Germany, not on the side of getting Germany out of the Netherlands, if nothing else. And that was one of the, I think, the important factors that changed attitudes in Holland. And of course, the church then played a primary role in isolating South Africa further and further. The Dutch church played a leading role. Anyway, so Charles had made these two series, and it's pretty we don't have time to he told me some of the humorous things that happened to him while he was filming it, but they won the awards. It was very well received. But the World at War started in South Africa, and those of you who may be as old as I am and remember that time, while the series was showing, I think one a week, and they were, I don't know, halfway through, three quarters way through, SABC announced that they were not going to show the Holocaust episode. And what you may not know is that Charles was in Johannesburg at the time. He and I were hanging out, and he was always very secretive. You'd meet him on a street corner, he'd have you laughing for 4 hours, and then he'd disappear somewhere. So he was in South Africa, completely under the radar. Nobody, his name was never mentioned. That in fact, he was the man behind this. During that time, as soon as Jeremy Isaacs heard about it, he flew out to South Africa and he said, it's all or nothing. You either run the whole series or none of it. And the SABC backed down, and it was, in fact, a broadcast. Now, after Charles left, he'd trained a young Afrikaans Pretoria University graduate by the name of Henny Serfontein to replace him, to actually be his runner on the Britbond stuff he was doing, and translate and check and so on. And after Charles left, Henny was at that time working for the Progressive Party, actually. He'd been a nationalist and had changed his views. And Joel Mervis asked him to join the paper, and he became their political correspondent, and he broke a lot of very important Broederbond stories. He had a very different style from Charles, whereas Charles was the introvert who gravitated towards intellectuals and documents. Henny would move into a hotel and have trays of food and drink, or shall we say drink and food, coming in and out of the hotel room for 36, 48 hours, and he'd come out with a great story. And I, at that stage, was Pretoria Bureau Chief of the Sunday Times, and Henny would come in, he couldn't type, and he would dictate it all to the secretary, he would put it on a telex in Pretoria and send it over to Joburg, and he would get these amazing leads. And that continued until Mervis retired. He was replaced by Tertius Myburgh. I'd heard a rumor before Tertius took over that Tertius was going to knock Henny out. We have a picture of Henny. Henny is still alive. He's in Joburg. He's not well, and I have been seeing him. But after Tertius promised him that everything would be fine, Henny saved his best stories for the first few issues of Tertius's Sunday Times. They were all spiked. And eventually he got a meeting with Meiberg where Meiberg said, look, you know, I don't think the Britain one's that important. It's just overrated and certainly not now. And it was the end of Henny. He was felt compelled to resign. He couldn't get anything published and never worked again either in any kind of full-term capacity. He wrote, made quite a lot of movie documentaries and so on, but had a tough time too, like Charlie. And now, some of you may ask the obvious question, why, if Tertius was against the Brudebourne, did he publish some Brudebourne stuff that was published some years later, written by Ivor Wilkins and Hans Stradom? And the answer to that is simply that what happened was, because of the work that Charlie had done and then followed up by Henny, anyone who wanted to give material on the Brudebourne knew the place to go was the Sunday Times. They understood it, they knew how to use it, and they would play it big. And so periodically stuff would arrive unsolicited. In fact, what happened was Ivor Wilkins got a call saying, come downstairs, there's something for you. And he said, no, I'm busy. And eventually they got him down. And it was the biggest dump of Brudebourne documents in history. And most comprehensive. So it was really just their luck. They then, Ivor's luck, he then worked with his news editor, Hans Stradom. They put it together. They did, Tertius did run the stuff for a few weeks. Henny argues only very much selectively and stuff that had fitted certain criteria. And then they couldn't get any more published and they wrote a book which is in the stores, the Super Afrikaners. So that's how it happened. I just want to finish this section by telling you, by quoting from Albert Kayser's letter, which was published in the Sunday Times after all of this, on the Brudebourne, for those who thought the Brudebourne was irrelevant or harmless. And this is what he said. The church lives by revelation. The Brudebourne thrives on concealment. The church is open to everyone. The Brudebourne is shut against the world. The church is universal. The Brudebourne is so particularist that it condemns the fights and fights everything remotely universal. The World Council of Churches, Rotary, Round Table, and Lions International. Christ calls to the light. The Brudebourne moves in the dark, etc., etc. Secret societies destroy the conscience of the individual because they force on him a double morality and a dual loyalty. The church and society's only recourse against them is to expose them. They're composed of light-sensitive material and are harmless outside their element. So, I think that... besides dropping the papers... concludes that, I accept to tell you about my conversation with Mandela about Charlie. Early one morning in 1992, I was doing a television interview with Mandela, and I asked him about Charlie again, you know, not knowing whether he would confirm or not confirm what Charlie had said. And he immediately said, oh yes, he was in the movement, you know. And I said I did, and he asked me where he could find him, and I had to give him the sad news that he'd died. He'd had 5 or 6 heart operations. His chest looked like a herringbone cartoon picture. His last one was a transplant, and so he died in 1985. So he never lived to see the changes. I now want to go on to the Rand Daily Mail, and I'm going to try to tell you as much as possible things you don't know about the Mail and the Muldergate and how that all came about. This is by the way is Ruth First with Winnie Mandela. That's Mandela with Mary Benson, who wrote one of the very first books on Mandela. That's Anthony Sampson, who was the very famous British journalist, famous after he came here, not before, who started, who really turned Drum into the great magazine it became. That's just one early picture with cover with Winnie. And that brings us to the mail. That's Laurie Gander and Benjamin Pogrand. Now, I marvel at some of you who do this all the time, like Bob. I'm not very used to doing all this in public. So now I want to tell you about Gander. When Gander took over, in fact, it was Harry O'Connor, another great journalist who worked for him, who said that before Gander took it over, the Mail was really a sort of jingo rag, like most English language newspapers in this country, not all of them. It was a promoter of colonialism, British jingoism, more so than the Argus papers even. Didn't really even begin to be a great newspaper until Lawrence Gander became editor. And one of the things that this tells is, you know, the Marxist argument is that the newspapers are the capitalist tool and they always represent capitalist interests. What this shows, I think, quite powerfully is there were individuals who really did make a difference, and after they were gone, that difference stopped happening. Lawrence Gander was a really interesting and quite strange character. He looked at home at an accountants' convention. He always looked down and never up. He was not comfortable in any kind of public role. He'd walk along the corridors and not greet you. But the chairman who hired him had known him in the war, and he said he was the most courageous man he'd ever known, both in war and in peace. And so he was a rather interesting and great intellectual. And as I looked into it, and by the way, this is a lot of this section is thanks to Gavin Stewart, former professor and former editor at the Daily Dispatch, who did quite a lot of this research and helped me find a very important column he wrote in which he set out his views, which I have to find. But just to introduce him, first of all, before they hired Gander, the chairman of the company at the time looked around in the company. The only person he could find to hire who he thought was capable of being an editor was Joel Mervis. The board vetoed him because he was Jewish. He then chose Gander and then insisted on having as business editor someone called Harold Frigeon, which the board tried to veto because he had committed the same offense of being Jewish. And Caper overrode him and insisted that he got the position. So it was Gander and Frigeon and others. So Gander came in. He had been influenced by the fact that he'd been in England when India got independence. He'd watched the independence of Ghana, or the driving towards independence of Ghana. He'd worked briefly for Anglo-American, where he'd gone to Northern Rhodesia on an assignment for Oppenheimer and the others, where he'd been asked to understand, to analyze the problems they were having, the labor problems they were having on their mines, on the copper mines. And he concluded what would be to us pretty obvious now, but that while the businesses had to take the flak for the lack of political voice, this would inevitably continue, and apparently this was somewhat impressive to them. And by the way, he'd been burned in effigy in Albert Park in Durban for some columns he'd written in Durban, but somehow that didn't prevent him getting the job in Joburg. And now he insisted on editorial independence when he took the job as editor, which his predecessors had not had. And so when he chose to switch allegiance from the United Party to the Progressive Party when Helen Suzman and the others moved, he did it deliberately without telling anyone in management, and they allowed it. They didn't react, they didn't take action against him. But it was, and he also brought in Nat Nakaza as a columnist, and some of you may know the story of Nat Nakaza, who'd come from Drum. I don't have time to tell you the story of Drum, and also it's probably a story that most of you know a little bit about, and there are a number of books on it, but Nat Nakaza also had a column in the Ron Daily Mail. And so this alienated people, but he got away with it. But the most important thing he ever wrote, I would say, is a column under the headline, "Yes, it does mean the whole hog." And this was a response to a challenge from, I think it was the Transvaaler, that said, "It's all very well, you liberals, you're all hypocrites. You criticize us for being too brutal and harsh, but what does it mean if we follow your policy? It's the thin edge of the wedge. Once you give an inch, you lose an arm," you know, all those arguments. And Gavin did something remarkable, and I must admit I didn't know about this till Gavin alerted it to me to it. And he said, "Yes, it does mean the whole hog. To be sure, the implications of multiracialism are far from pleasant for the privileged white group. I often think the protagonists of multiracialism harm their cause by pretending otherwise." It's pretty courageous to say, because it was really, this was written in March the 21st, 1964, at a time when the Pitt Mayer was running a conference on anti-communism, which was equating liberalism to communism. A lot of people had been banned and arrested, so it was really courageous to say this too, not just to the government, but to his own readers. Yet the case for integration of the races does not rest on unreal assumptions that everyone will live happily ever after. It rests on the plain fact that there is no practical alternative, for not even the nationalists are prepared to face the appalling costs and risks of genuine partition on an India-Pakistan basis. The nationalists enjoy pointing out that once we accept the fact of integration, there's no stopping the process. One concession leads to another until all is conceded. The nationalists are right. This is how change takes place in multiracial societies such as ours. But we must face it, since we cannot do otherwise. And it is surely easier to guide the forces of change by working with them rather than against them. And I'll read one more paragraph or two. The nationalists also point out that integration means mixed schools, mixed hospitals, mixed cinemas, mixed social gatherings, and even mixed marriages. Indeed, it does. It means the dismantling of color bars in every sphere. It means the likelihood of having a black family as one's neighbors, a black man as one's boss. Unthinkable, no doubt. But then the history of multiracial communities is essentially the story of the reluctant accepting the unthinkable. And then the last little bit I'll read, he wasn't a practicing Christian, but he did say, "Does Christianity not teach us to be ready to suffer, and if necessary to lose all for what we know to be right and just? Is it not preferable to serve our less fortunate fellow man than to hold ourselves apart, clutching our own privileges to our bosom? Apartheid is a contraction of the human spirit, an impoverishing of self-concern, a retreat from life. Integration is meeting life and entering its stream." In response to which the Afrikaans press had a field day, the Vaderland is the one I'll quote. They said, "Donkey and knee donkey. Thanks, but no thanks." And they did say, we can't accuse him of double sinnigheid. We cannot be accused of being ambiguous or having double meanings, whatever you think of his answer. Thank you, Mr. Donkey, Meneer Gander, for the eerlijkheid. Nie donkey for the zelfvernietigingseis. Thank you, Mr. Gander, for your honesty. No thanks for your demand that we commit suicide. We don't have too much time left, so I'm going to rush through. He then also it was Benji Pogrand who then did the prisons cases, and also did the first stories on nutrition, lack of nutrition, which was also panned by the government party press. The one other thing I want to say is that Benji Pogrand on the right here, many of you know, it was Benji and Charles Bloomberg who were the two journalists from the mainstream press who used to meet with Mandela in secret while he was on the run. They didn't much like each other. They never talked about it outside. And they were politically different. Benji was strongly anti-communist, and which I would argue put him into a rather awkward position, because he was a friend of Robert Sobukwe and obviously seemed to have a preference for the Pan-Africanist Congress, which was not communist. It was against the ANC. But he writes frankly in his book, The War of Words, which is still around, that when he attended PAC rallies, he was treated with naked hostility because he was white. But when he went to ANC events, he was treated with utmost courtesy. And Nelson Mandela, on the back of it, of Benji's book, says, that they had a good relationship, and their friendship overrode their differences on how best to galvanize the South African masses for the overthrow of apartheid. But his courage in supporting the general cause of liberation and the use of his journalistic skills towards this end enormously increased my respect for him. I'm going to have to rush things a little bit because I want to have enough time to get through Muldergate before we finish here, because there are some things about it that are not commonly known, I hope. But just to say that when Gander was forced out over all of this, Raymond Lowe came in. And Raymond, we talked a little bit yesterday about Francis Dormer, who had this particular ability to, had the breadth of skills for a good journal, for a good editor, both commercial as well as editorial, and Ray Lowe really was that character. He had strengths in all the places Gander did not. They were a good team, but once Gander left, Ray did a remarkable job. He was a very strong newsman. He built the circulation of the paper every year, and he made it profitable. And the way he made it profitable was he thought of something rather shrewd, which was that the Rand Daily Mail had a smaller circulation than the Star, the two main dailies in Johannesburg, but he also knew that the people who decide where to put ads are the ad agencies, and the ad agencies get a percentage, I think 16 or 16.5% on every ad. So as long as they get less for the Rand Daily Mail ads than the Star, they're going to point everyone to the Star. So he said, no, we're going to charge the same as the Star, even though we have a smaller circulation. And the reason what he would give was, look, we're a thinner paper, your ads will stand out more. And it worked. And he did expand the paper and so on. And of course, it did become a very lively paper under him, I would say. I would argue far more lively than Star. But it was very successful. The paper did really well. And in fact, when it started doing badly, that was one of the decisions that was reversed by management without consulting Ray. Anyway, just to get into Muldergate, what happened was that after 10 years of Gander and 9 years of Ray Lowe, the government had had enough. Rudy writes that no dinner party in Eshel Rudy, the Secretary of Information who led the campaign against the Rand Daily Mail, he's the one on the left, with Van den Berg, who was the boss. There was a close alliance between Eshel Rudy, the Information Department, the boss, General Van den Berg, and the Transvaal leadership of the National Party. And that was really the formation that was behind it all, and it was eventually brought down by P.W. Botha and Muldergate. What I want to say is Rudy did research, and his research through two universities showed that anti-apartheid and United Nations publications attacking investments in South Africa, illustrating cruelties in race relations, and advocating disinvestment in South Africa, or the blocking of any further new investments, were based for 80% of the space on information which appeared in the Rand Daily Mail and the Financial Mail, followed by the Sunday Times and the Star. So he argued that the real danger to the country was coming from the Mail. He also said the Foreign Press Corps in South Africa lives on the Rand Daily Mail. Some foreign journalists hardly bother to change a word. I suspect that was a bit of an exaggeration, but not entirely. The opinion of millions of people in 24 countries were being shaped not by the independent observation of the foreign press in South Africa, but by the Rand Daily Mail. The uniformity of reports in German, French, English, Spanish, and Dutch newspapers is striking. So, in August 1975, he hosted a lunch to plan the retaliation. What's interesting about this moment, just to give it to you very quickly, Connie Mulder had been asked by John Forster to go to Parliament and propose a new press censorship, which he duly did. The reaction was such uproar that John Forster stepped in as the peacemaker, as the moderate, and said, no, we won't let Connie Mulder do that. We'll stop the press censorship plan. Connie Mulder was furious because he felt set up by Forster. And he actually agreed that censorship wasn't the solution. What is the solution? Don't censor it, own it. you may reflect on whether that has any resonances for what's happening in South Africa today. And so it was at this meeting, August 75, that Rudi sat with Mulder, Van den Berg, and several others and discussed how they were going to take over the English press. And in these meetings, by the way, they knew what Raylow and the others were saying because they had a bug in his flower pot. So they would actually quote from the bug in the flower pot in these meetings and in the documents. I'll go through this rather quickly. We know that they did consult Forster. Forster was involved. We've got ample evidence of that. They got Louis Leite as the front person, then Sir de Villiers Craft came in. And at the last minute, Harry Oppenheimer stepped in. And I have a quote here, I won't read it to you. I lent them some money to enable them to get going and avoid the Louis Leite takeover. I didn't know who was behind it, but I was sure that, you know, there was something going on. There was something behind this rather strange movement, and I didn't think it was desirable. Oppenheimer stepped in and solved it. The shares were bought by a trust controlled by sympathetic people, and it was left alone. But this is how it began to unravel. Forster had said in a meeting on November 3rd, 1975, to Rudi, "Jelle moet net oppas dat jelle nie jelle jas in die deur vastdraai nie." Forster's only warning was that all possible efforts should be made to maintain secrecy. Be careful not to get your coat caught in the door. However, this is how it came out. Someone in the Union Bank of Switzerland, someone very senior, had a meeting with Anton Rupert, and seems to me like a breach of ethics, but he told Rupert that the money was a guarantee, that there was money there as a guarantee for the citizen. Rupert went straight to Forster, and Forster then said he knew nothing of the project. And 2 days later, according to Rudi, Forster called him backstage at the Pretoria City Hall during a meeting and said, "You need to solve this." Rudi then went to Switzerland. Actually, the banker was in Italy that weekend, and they worked out a plan to conceal it. But the problem was that Forster had lied to Rupert. If he had come clean with him, then we always say it's the cover-up that gets you in these scandals, not the original crime. He might have been able to survive, but he had sealed his fate. Once he'd done that to Rupert, he felt compelled to continue the lie. Just trying to work out how to summarize a little bit. Interestingly, Rudi knew things that others didn't. Even after he'd fallen, he actually said that he said, "Wouldn't it be a surprise if, even though I'm out, if the Royal Daily Mail closes anyway in the next 2 years?" In fact, that is what happened. The chairman of the company, McPherson, was most unsympathetic to Raylow, called him in to interfere in the paper and ask questions about it, and one day said, "You'll see where you are in 2 years' time." And in fact, in 2 years' time, he was fired. Ironically, of course, also this was now into 1976, and if you look at the dates, it's a really extraordinary period because the Daily Mail was living its finest hour. Many of its journalists went to jail, but they did a fantastic coverage of the Soweto 76 uprising. I want to finish by getting back to why the Mail closed. And I would argue that, this is Harry Oppenheimer, I would argue that one of the reasons, I've got a list of reasons, but one of them was that Oppenheimer's views had changed, and partly because P.W. Botha's views had changed. I know the conventional view is it ran out of money, but I think I've partly dealt with that already. Oppenheimer was already retired, but if he'd said this has to be saved, he could have done it out of the petty cash till laws, you know, wouldn't have been a problem to stop it, or a phone call. But If you read Oppenheimer's speeches at the time, and I've got them, we don't really have time, we've got about 7 minutes to go, and I want to leave a little bit of time for question. He made two speeches overseas, one in London and one in, I think, New York, in which he said that P.W. Botha is making a genuine, though slow and cautious, effort to reform. And frankly, if you look at it, he was, by the lights of what had been set up to then by Oppenheimer as well as others. 99-year leasehold rights for black township residents, the end of influx control, the first government acceptance of blacks in the urban areas, job reservation ending, black education improving, mixed trade unions operating, black wages rising. And then he says, to behave as though South Africa could peacefully introduce to accept a constitution based on universal suffrage, which would place unlimited power in the hands of any demagogue who could muster the support of 51% of the electorate, evidences either ignorance or hypocrisy. Well, that was in 1985, and of course 5 years later that's exactly what the government set itself to do. So what I want to argue is that Oppenheimer saw real change, and there was real change, but of course he was out of touch with what was acceptable by that stage on the ground. Secondly, Anglo was itself having problems with its non-mining companies, and that was an argument for it to say, look, why were it, you know, Ford Motor Company, which they bought the South African branch of, they were having trouble with, and here was the newspapers, and there was, you know, there was this feeling, why should we do that? Of course, there were losses, for which I would say there was a solution, and there were solutions were put to them, but which were ignored. And then finally, and I think probably least important, is PW did go on a seduction campaign with Harry Oppenheimer. First of all, the company was given a quarter share. Each of the English papers were given, companies were given a quarter share in Mnet, which was the first commercial television in South Africa and would obviously prove a cash cow. He also gave Oppenheimer a medal and, you know, did all sorts of things like that, but obviously that in itself wouldn't have been especially important. I think we need to stop there. We've only got 5 minutes left, in case you have any questions. Yes? Well, it's very interesting, you know, because I've been, it still exists. I can't tell you exactly what they're up to and exactly how strong, but they still exist. I went a few years ago to, I mean, well into the democracy era, to a meet, to a press lunch with the head of the Broederbond and asked him a couple of basic questions which he professed ignorance of, and that made me somewhat suspicious. I asked him about the Broederbond's policy, which is very well documented, of manipulating appointments. And he said he knew nothing about that. So that left me unimpressed. So I think they're still active. I do think now, and I'll give you one quick bit of speculation, because I've been talking to some Broederbond members in Stellenbosch, who are still part of the old school in a way. And they are looking for some kind of new CODESA, some kind of new compact in the time of Zuma, because they feel that, not political so much as probably economic and social, but they feel, you know, with all the problems now under Zuma and so on, and whites being, Afrikaners especially in the, from their point of view, being unhappy, that some kind of way of coming together needs to happen, and I think that's what they're trying to do. But of course, they don't have the power they had before because they're not in government. Yeah.
I'm British, and to us in the UK, the face of the Rand Daily Mail was Stanley Hayes.
Yes.
Who sadly died the other day.
Yes.
Was he seen as an important figure in the Rand Daily Mail over here in South Africa, or was it merely his status?
Well, his main work in when he was in South Africa, he didn't work for the Rand Daily Mail. He worked for the Sunday Times. So he worked with Mertz, he was very close to Mertz, he was an assistant editor to Mertz. And he played a big role covering politics as a political editor, and he would oversee Charles and Henny. But I should just tell you that Stan met Mandela in the early 60s, late 50s, And they didn't hit it off that well. And when Mandela saw him after he came out, he might have said, you weren't that impressed with me, were you? But what standard then was, when Tertius came in, he didn't get on with him, and he got the London Bureau. And so then he was writing for the whole group, which included the Rock Daily Mail. But he was very sort of the doyen of those journalists. And also from South Africa, when he was here in Cape Town, he was one of the main foreign correspondents writing for British news. Yeah.
One of the sort of loose cannons in the whole situation who didn't really clarify his role is now writing a column for the Sunday Times, which of course is Stephen Mulholland. And Mulholland is not a guy who pulls punches, is he?
No, he's not a guy who pulls punches.
He's a foreman. There was quite a thought that he was set up as the sort of hatchet man for the Rand Daily Mail.
Well, he was set up as a hatchet man, but in fact the Mail was closed as he took over. So you can try and blame him for lots of things. You can't blame him for closing the Mail. What I do blame him for, because I'm doing research on it, is he gave away the Rand Daily Mail archive to University in Johannesburg. And they have just informed me that they've incinerated it. Well, they said it was unavoidable and there was nothing political about it. And I kind of believe them in the sense that it had been allowed to get into a state of ruin and there were whatever, worms or whatever in it. But the archive was incinerated. It was his decision to not bother to keep it. But you can't blame him for closing the Mail. That decision had been taken. Yeah.
Which newspapers exactly did the Rodian Company try to take over? My memory was it was the Morning Group.
Yes, without going into details, the Morning Group means something slightly different from what you think it means. South African Associated Newspapers was the listed company, and that would have included the Sunday Times, the Rand Daily Mail, the Cape Times, the Natal Mercury, Eastern Province Herald, and the Daily Dispatch was half owned and was coming into the fold at that time. Yeah.
Yeah. You haven't mentioned the role of the Sunday Express and its editor, and they were particularly active in investigative journalism during this period.
Yes, well, I'm glad you mentioned because I was there, and I got the only jail sentence for Mulligator, and it was on the Sunday Express. The Express really did play the main role. I've deliberately decided in these lectures not to tell you things you probably already know and that are easily accessible, but the Express really drove the process. It was the Express more than the Mail that was kept breaking new ground, and the Mail had a lot more resources, but they actually followed in its stream. But what I've been trying to show, because this has been raised by some question by some historians, is that it was really the Rand Daily Mail that they were targeting. And in fact, by the time they really got going, Raylo was already out. And of course, then all sorts of other things happened.
Was that Mervyn Rees that was on the Express?
No, it was Kit Katzen on the Express.
Mervyn Rees, did he play a big role?
Mervyn Rees was on the Rand Daily Mail. He did an enormous amount of work. He was the primary researcher on it. But if you read his books, you'll see that he and Alistair Sparks, the editor, differed over publishing. And Mervyn was ready to publish, Alistair's position as editor was that he was afraid of the Mail being closed if it published. So he wanted to accumulate more and more material so that when he published, it all came out. That went on for so long that some people in the audience know the story all too well. Rex Gibson, the editor of the Sunday Express, decided to go with that story saying, it's a lie, 12 million rand spent on the Citizen, it turned out to be 32 million, which replaced the front page lead I'd already written and already been set, which said that Pip Wurters is just seeing the Shah of Iran to confirm our oil imports just before the Shah got pushed out of Iran himself. So it was the Express that did the primary. Yeah.
How significant was Donald Woods' influence in that period?
Donald was banned in October 1977. So until then, I think that's the correct date, that was the big attack on the press. Until then, he wrote this wonderful column. I remember living in Pretoria reading it every week. which really cheered me up immensely. But remember, he was editor of the Daily Dispatch, which was a small paper by the standards of this. Anything more before we close? Yes?
Excuse me, it's not a question, but I would love just to contribute to the point. You are very negative towards the Broederbond.
Yes.
But they have done enormous, a lot of good also. They were very important in the 30s when the Afrikaner was Arm Blankies.
Yeah.
They developed the Afrikaner to what they became later, intellectual, also educational, etc. Also getting their language as the official language. And the Afrikaner, and they also saw that Sanlam was formed. They also saw that Volksgas was formed. They also have contributed a lot of that. So at least the Afrikaner have no political power, but at least culturally they are tops. And what is the difference between the Broederbond and, for example, the Jewish Council? I just ask. At the moment, the Broederbond is open. Anyone can belong to it if you want to, and they do a lot of cultural work. That's all I would say. And it will help maybe if we can use some of Herman Guillaume's ideas about the Broederbond also. They're not just all doom and gloom. They've done enormous when the Afrikaner was down out in the 30s, moving up from the Anglo-Boer War right up to there to where they came, around the Afrikaans University was formed, and where they came politically, financially, intellectually, culturally. That's all I would say.
Thank you for that. I agree with you in terms of culturally and socially. The problem I think I would have is politically, and that doesn't apply anymore.
Also,
Yeah, but they got the educated blacks,
and it's
worth
educated. No, the blacks were,
a
lot of universities were filmed.
Okay, I thank you. I appreciate your raising it, and it took courage, and thank you for doing it. Okay.
The story for football, I don't know if you know Steve Van Horn plays it very often on the daughter, Mary.
Did he?
And I knew this because I lived in the Pink House in Parker, and he would pitch up a case in the house and he'd play the girl. I asked him why he dated his
Well, you know, I